say, this is weird. This is Neil, and I am introducing this bonus episode of The Cinematologist without Dario, which is strange and sad, and I don't quite like it. But it's part of a new thing that we're trialing, so just gotta stick in there and go with it. This is an episode featuring some interviews and kind of chat with the filmmaker Alex Barrett. I've known Alex for a long time from my days running the Filmstock Film Festival. And recently he came down to the School of Film and Television at Falmouth to screen and talk about his latest film, London Symphony, which is a city symphony all about England's capital and its diverse wonders and joys and kind of fascinating changes and evolutions in the past sort of decades. And it's a wonderful silent film with a beautiful score. And it's around now. So we thought it'd be a good time to share this because Alex is currently out and about with the film and you can see it in a number of places. He's touring with it at various places. The film is touring cinemas and community cinemas and all sorts of wonderful places across the capital and beyond. And he's doing that tour through till February. So check out londonsymphfilm.com. I'll put the link on the show notes. And see if it's playing near you, because it really is a wonderful experience on the big screen. If you want to watch it at home, you can currently watch it via the BFI player, and it has a fantastic interview from Mark Commode. It's his pick of the week on there, so you can see it with that introduction or just see it without. And again, I'll put a link to that up on the site. So there are places to see it. If you aren't in the UK, you're thinking, how can I see it? It is available worldwide on DVD from Flickr Alley. And again, I'll put a link up, and it should be available in the new year for UK DVD purchasers. Today's episode includes a chat that Alex and I had before the Q&A, and just about various bits and pieces. And then I've tagged on the Q&A with the audience here at the School of Film and Television. So some really fascinating, interesting stuff, hopefully, for fans of silent cinema, for fans of kind of independent filmmaking, all that kind of stuff. And apologies for the audio in the Q&A bit. It's a little quiet in places, but it's, again, just trying to get all this stuff out there so that those who are interested can have a listen. So thanks very much to Alex for coming down and sharing his time and sharing his thoughts and being so generous with his honesty and his kind of insight into the filmmaking process of this incredibly unique film. And thanks for kind of coming on the podcast. Thanks to you for listening. And this is myself and Alex Barrett. I'm joined by Alex Barrett, director of London Symphony, who's literally just stepped off the train, pretty much. So thanks for joining us, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
You're here in Falmouth to screen London Symphony, which is your wonderful city symphony about London. Title's quite self-explanatory in that sense. How are you doing? You're currently touring it. How's it been going out there with the film?
It's been going really well. So we're doing about 45 dates or 45 venues. It's over 50 dates, but in about 45 venues up and down the country throughout the UK. And we're about sort of halfway through the tour now. It's going really well, actually. We've had a really nice response. Been doing Q&As at quite a few of the screenings. So it's been nice to kind of talk to people afterwards. And couldn't really be going any better. We're very happy with what's been going on.
Cool. I wondered what the audience makeup's going to be. Is it a kind of mixture of people who would be familiar with something, a film like this, so an older audience, but also, you know, who else is kind of coming out, do you think, to see the film?
It's definitely a mixture. So I think we launched the tour at the Barbican with live music, and that sold out. And that was, I think, slightly more of a kind of silent film audience. And also kind of people that had backed the film when we did the crowdfunding campaign. So people that kind of knew about the film or that were kind of interested in silent film generally. But for the other screenings, it's actually been quite interesting to kind of see the audiences, because a lot of them have been older people, should we say. That's probably not the politest way of saying it. But it has kind of skewed a bit older. which, just on a side note, has made it quite hard to track, actually, because, you know, you always ask people to kind of tweet about it and things like that, but a lot of the people that have been coming kind of aren't the kind of social media crowd. So we're not quite sure how they're finding out about it, because obviously a lot of our crowdfunding campaign is based online. Promotion is based online. But what's been interesting is a lot of those people, even though they're maybe slightly older, aren't people that necessarily know about the City Symphony genre. And I've had a lot of kind of conversations after screenings of, you know, what was the name of that City Symphony you mentioned? Can you tell me again so I can write it down? It's kind of, I don't really know where people are coming from or quite how they're gravitating towards it. I suppose some people have sort of an interest in the city. Some people are probably local to or interested in the venues that we're screening in, because as well as kind of traditional cinemas, we're doing film clubs, which obviously have their own audience. But then we're also doing things like parish churches, Buddhist meditation centres, Hindu temples. So it's a sort of an excuse for people to come along to maybe a different type of venue as well.
Yeah, and it must be nice to kind of just to get in the room with people and be able to enjoy the film and the experience of the film, kind of take it out there, that is more akin to, you know, how those films would have been viewed in the past. So a kind of away from social media almost. Kind of really tactile, kind of face-to-face response with people.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been really nice.
So you're about halfway through, what's the goal for after the film's kind of finished this tour? What's the plan?
Yeah, good question. I suppose we're being asked at every single screening, when's it coming out on DVD? So we have a distributor in America called Flickr Alley who have put it out as of yesterday, I think, on Blu-ray in America. But it's a region-free Blu-ray, so apart from the sort of exchange rate, it's very easily accessible. And it's also streaming worldwide through them, outside of the UK. So that kind of takes the international market off our hands, if you want. That's all kind of sewn up through Flickr Alley. And then in terms of the UK, because we are being asked so often for DVD, we will probably try and do something. If we can't find a distributor, we'll probably do it ourselves. We are talking about actually trying to get that out before Christmas, so we hit the kind of Christmas market, in case people want to buy copies for their friends. But the tour actually goes on until February, so we'll see. And we are in contract negotiation stage with a UK streaming site, which I probably can't expand on, but hopefully if that sort of goes through as planned, that would be before the end of the year probably as well.
Great stuff. You're not kind of new to touring your work in this way. Obviously you did festivals with your shorts, that's how we met way back in the day, and Life Just Is had a similar kind of, you know, that seems to be the way that the films are kind of being released now, in terms of the filmmaker in attendance or crew in attendance and kind of getting out there. And is that something that you feel comfortable with? And, you know, do you think that that is kind of how it's going to have to be now for indie work kind of moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. There's been quite a lot of kind of controversy recently about the Q&A. I don't know if you saw this kind of discussion about whether there's been a lot of kind of questioning as to whether director Q&As after screenings are beneficial or not, should we say. As a punter, I quite like going to Q&As. I mean, I quite like hearing what filmmakers have to say. I don't necessarily know if, in a weird way, filmmakers are always the best interpreters of their work. But it's always kind of interesting to hear what they say, and I'm always, as a filmmaker myself, I'm always quite interested to hear about the kind of background of the production and, you know, the kind of practical side of things. I think it's just, you know, venues, I mean, with a film like ours, especially any venue that show it, that is putting it on, is basically taking a risk. And, I think we have to acknowledge that. And, we've been amazed by the support that we've had and very thankful for the support that we've had. And so in terms of kind of doing a Q&A or something like that, it helps the venue feel slightly more comfortable, I think, because generally speaking, there is a perception that you will get a better audience if there's a Q&A. I don't always know if that's actually the case. You always find that Q&As, generally speaking, actually ours have been quite good, but generally speaking, you'll find that a lot of the audience will walk out before the Q&A starts. Yeah. And so it's always slightly weird that there's this perception that Q&A helps pull in a bigger crowd, and actually clearly not all of the crowd are, you know, even staying. Yeah. But actually our retention has been quite good. We've had a lot of people staying on for the Q&As, which is nice. And because we have been showing at some, as I said, some unusual venues and some more kind of community-focused venues, we have engaged in quite kind of open discussions as well, which has been really good.
Yeah.
I don't really know. I mean, one thing that I do think we're doing, which is quite nice, is most of the venues, with one or two exceptions, are only kind of showing it for one or two nights. And I think that that's probably the way forward for independent film. And that was something that we were keen to do, was to kind of do more venues for less nights per venue,
yeah.
and kind of doing like one... You know, so my previous film had 2 weeks at the BFI South Bank, which was amazing because it's the South Bank. And actually we did fairly well kind of consistently throughout the run. It was a fairly even spread. But for a film like London Symphony, it's kind of... I'm not sure if a week in a London cinema... I mean, I'd rather kind of do five London cinemas and have one night in each, I think makes it slightly more of an event and motivates people to get out and see it, really.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Great. Your kind of interest in silent cinema as a filmmaker kind of extends, you know, quite a way back in terms of the films you've been making. But the film definitely taps into the moment that silent cinema is having. How gratifying is it to see, you know, in relative terms, a lot of attention being paid to the form of, you know, what is known as silent cinema, and kind of almost kind of assessing and reassessing that era of film and not kind of bringing it into the modern day, because that sounds so trite, but understanding that that form has a relevance that is not bound to its early kind of early days, as it were.
No, I mean, it's great. I'm obviously a massive fan of silent cinema. That's kind of why one of the reasons why this project came around, and it's great that it seems to be having a kind of a general resurgence at the moment. I mean, obviously The Artist a few years ago is the kind of film that people point to, and was kind of one of the best known, but there is just a real interest, I think, certainly within London. You have things like the Kennington Bioscope, which are really kind of you know, wonderful events that are showing some really great films and just kind of helping to build this interest. Mm. One of the things that we found that's been quite interesting with the film, and also kind of generally, is there is a slight resistance, I think, between people that love silent cinema to contemporary silent film. And that has actually been something that we've had to try and sort of almost overcome. You know, we obviously thought when we were making the film that the target audience would be silent cinema fans. And we're finding that that is only partly the case, because actually a lot of them kind of don't want to watch anything that was made after about 1930, 32. So that's been interesting. And it's been great for us at screenings. You know, as I was saying just now, people kind of coming up to me and saying, oh, you know, the City Symphony, tell me more. And, you know, how can I see the examples and that. That's great. You know, two of the nicest reactions that we have to the film are when people ask us more about the genre and the kind of form, or when they come up to us and say, where was that location? I want to go and visit it.
Yeah.
And those, for me, are kind of two of the nicest reactions to get.
Great. That's interesting, that, isn't it, about the people not wanting... Assuming silent cinema like is a period as opposed to a thing. I think that speaks to the kind of... Definitely the moment we're having in terms of fandom, in terms of nailing your flags to the mast so specifically. Which is a shame, because obviously they'll miss out on what is a beautiful film that... You know, is both contemporary but also kind of inspired by the films that were made at that time rather
yeah.
than, you know, silent cinema.
No, very much. And I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this in the Q&A, but I mean, we always felt that silent cinema in a way is a kind of a different form of expression from sound cinema, but it's perfectly valid. And I think it's kind of, you know, ridiculous to say, well, you can't make a silent film anymore and, you know, it shouldn't be done. But I think that what has happened from kind of talking to some of the people that have kind of been to the silent film festivals and stuff, I think there have been quite a lot of contemporary silence that have not been very good and have kind of been pastiches or kind of, you know, Chaplin-esque things with kind of, you know, fake scratches on and all that kind of thing, which is obviously very clearly not what we've tried to do. And I think that that's kind of a shame, that maybe a few of these kind of pastiches have sort of ruined it for people that want to try and do something a bit more seriously in the medium. But I'm still kind of a believer that there is a resurgence, and I hope that, you know, that will continue, and hopefully some of these barriers will kind of be broken down. We just need more people to make silent films that you know, are good.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you've definitely achieved that, so well done. Thanks for joining us. We're going to head into the end of the screening now, and then have a Q&A with the students here at the School of Film and Television. But for now, thanks for joining me, Alex.
please welcome the director of the film, Alex Barrett. So I'm going to start things off with a couple of questions and then I'll turn it over to you guys. Hopefully you've got stuff that you want to know and want to ask. So first off, just kind of how did... I know how the project came together, but could you sort of let us know how London Symphony came into being?
Sure. So there are kind of a few different factors that all kind of came together at the same time. So one of them was that in sort of 2008, 2009, me, the composer and the writer of the film, had made a short film called Hungerford Symphony of London Bridge, and actually originated for a competition that we made it, and the brief was to kind of make a film about the city that you live in. And we decided that we would do one basically as a tribute to the kind of city symphonies and the cine poems of the 1920s. We felt that kind of style of filmmaking was still a very valid form of filmmaking. We obviously love films from the silent era, but I think that there's a slight sort of difference between films from the silent era and films from the sound era, and we think that they're perfectly valid forms still. And just because you can shoot in colour and widescreen and sound doesn't necessarily mean that you should. So we wanted to do something that was kind of a tribute to those forms of filmmaking. And then in kind of that project, that short film, it's only 3 minutes, but the whole thing had been incredibly quick and easy and fun. And in sort of 2013, I was looking for a project off the back of my first feature, which was a kind of a character drama, and that had taken 7 years to make and had been quite a kind of the opposite of a quick and fun project, really, in some ways. So we started talking about doing a feature-length version, essentially, of that short that would look at the whole of London, thinking that it would only take us a few months and it'd be another kind of quick and easy project. And, you know, 4.5 years later, we're still sort of, you know, we're now just touring it and it's just finished. So it certainly wasn't the kind of quick, easy project that we wanted it to be. But that was kind of one of the reasons. But it was also, at that time, it was the rise of a kind of divisive politics within the UK. And so we thought it might be an interesting time to basically do something that was celebrating the city and specifically celebrating the kind of cosmopolitan nature of the city and the diversity of religions. So something basically a kind of slap in the face to UKIP, essentially, was kind of one...
It was a good motivation.
Yeah, was kind of one of the ideas. But it was also, the era of austerity, but yet there was still loads of building work happening around London. And so we were also interested in kind of looking at that, and also in the physical, the physical shape of the city was changing because there's so much building work in London. So we also thought that it would be interesting to kind of capture the city before it totally changed. So it's sort of a combination, really, of all of those reasons was sort of what led to the making of the film.
I imagine the city's changed almost in that period of time. Like you say, those buildings are going up like crazy. Did you notice kind of when you were shooting places and going back to them that it already shifted?
Absolutely, 100%. And we tried not to recce too much for the film, but in the odd locations sometimes, or you know where we did, or we would kind of, there was one site that I kind of stumbled across, as you'll have seen, as a section in the film where it's kind of like old and new buildings sort of side by side. And I saw a great shot like that, but I didn't have my camera with me. And when I went back a few weeks later, the old building had gone. And things like that were happening. And now, you know, you kind of see things in London. I'm like, oh, I wish that had been there when we were filming. There's a great new building near Vauxhall. I'm like, oh, I wish that was in the film, but it wasn't there when we were filming. There's a lot of that. But it's also sort of emotionally, the city has changed since we started making it. When we started making it, as I said, it was kind of the rise of UKIP, but it was pre-Brexit. And then obviously, you know, just in the last few months, there have been incidents in London that have sort of changed the city, shall we say. And city symphonies, I think, going back to the 20s, the original city symphonies, as well as being films about cities, are also films about the time in which they were made. And I do see London Symphony as much as a kind of era of the time as a film about London and kind of life today. We always thought that the most interesting thing about this film is to watch it again in 10 years or 20 years and see how the city has changed. But, you know, ultimately the film has taken us 4 years to make. And actually the city has changed so much in those 4 years that it's already sort of a document of a time that was...
has been.
Has already gone.
Yeah. And we weren't expecting it to change so quickly.
You sort of mentioned about the time it took, just sort of let us a little bit about how the film is kind of funded and the process of making it, because obviously it's entirely crowdfunded. Is that, does that play into how long it takes in terms of your ability to get out and physically make the work?
Yes, I mean, I think we definitely underestimated how long we thought the film was going to take. And I think that was partly because, as I said, the short film had been so kind of quick and easy. But of course, the short film was just looking at one location. It was just that one bridge in London. And as soon as you start thinking about the whole of London, it's such a big place, and it means so many different things to so many different people, that it just became a much bigger project. And so our initial schedule, I think, was kind of a 2-year process. And that was on the basis of filming in 200 locations. But when we did our crowdfunding campaign, we then started kind of talking to other people and doing further research. And suddenly our list of locations doubled to 400 locations. And ultimately in the film, we got through about 325 of the planned locations. So it was on such a big scale. And something else that happened was, while we were crowdfunding, I got a phone call from someone saying, will you move to India and head up a script department of a production company? And I said, well, I can't move to India. I'm about to make a film about London. But we basically then worked out a way that I could do the job from London. So having thought that I was just going to take a few months off and shoot this film quickly, suddenly the shoot became a much bigger shoot than we had planned, but I also then suddenly had a full-time job that I hadn't kind of counted on having. And then my composer had a baby and took a long time to write the score. So there were a whole kind of series of things that just meant that the film took a lot longer than we thought. So it's partly just because the scale of the project itself grew, and then there were kind of real world or life circumstances, should we say, that kind of got in the way. So yeah, it just ended up, you know, basically being an evening and weekends project for everyone involved. And it is very hard to make a film of this size. And my composer particularly was daunted by having to write a 68-minute piece of music, and that was actually ended up being a very slow process. And the grade ended up taking ages. We thought that would be a simple process, but, you know, it's like over 1,000 shots, and so even that's black and white to individually adjust every single one of those shots, it takes time.
Yeah. You do something that we do as well as filmmakers, which we did, you know, sort of did a film swap almost, which is at a certain point you send it out to people that you trust to get their feedback. How important is it for you to kind of open up the work towards the end of it being made, and in terms of helping them think about finishing it or kind of addressing some of the things that are brewing in terms of how you think about the work?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm actually, one thing that I do wrong, I think, often is I send work out too soon. And actually, I don't wait till the end of the process. I kind of start sending stuff out quite early on, which sometimes I think is not for the best. So with this film, for instance, obviously it's in four movements, and I was kind of treating each movement slightly as an independent work to an extent. And so there were some people that were basically getting it movement by movement and kind of were seeing it with holes in. So some of the stuff that we shot kind of towards the end of the process. So I should say, I suppose, that we basically started filming, and when we got to something, having got through about 300 locations or something, I realised that I had so much material that I probably had more than enough for a film feature. So I basically edited a rough cut before we'd officially finished the shoot. And then we kind of went back and just picked up some of the locations that we needed to fill in the holes. And officially, we never finished our shoot. We never finished everything that we planned to do because I just had too much material and we didn't need it. So there were some people that were kind of getting stuff even before we'd kind of finished the shoot. And I even held like a little test screening at my house for a few film critic friends of mine came around. And they made some really interesting points. Like, they were kind of like, you know, there's not enough nighttime stuff. You haven't shown, you know, the kind of seedy Soho side. So prior to them seeing it, there was no kind of nightclub at the end, and there was no sex shops in Soho. So all of that was kind of a direct result of feedback. I think it is really important, but it's also important to stick to your guns and have a vision and not get kind of confused and clouded. And so after that kind of mini test screening, we did a proper test screening a few months later. And that was to some of our backers, some friends, and just kind of, I think we ran a competition and gave away a few tickets, so it was kind of a bit of a mix. And the response there was really good. And there were a lot of kind of positives that people were bringing up. But in terms of the kind of, well, negatives, for want of a better word, there was no consensus. So the overall feedback was really positive and everyone liked it. But in terms of kind of what they were saying didn't work, no two people basically said the same thing. And that was kind of confusing because they all had an opinion on something that wasn't quite working. But as there was no consensus, you kind of just made the decision to ignore it all, pretty much. So actually the film didn't change very much after that. I think I cut 4 minutes out of it, and that was the biggest change that it made.
Great. One more before I turn it over. There's a writer credit for Raheem, obviously. Mm-hmm. Could you sort of explain kind of what the writer does of a project like this? Which obviously when you look at it, you think, well, you know, how is that written in a traditional sense? And what's your relationship as a director in terms of working with a writer and that kind of thing?
Sure. So so basically, when I decided that I wanted to make the feature version, essentially, of the short film, the first two phone calls I made were to Raheem to say, will you write this with me? And to Jim, my composer, and say, will you do the music? And I don't think I'd have done the film without either of them. If either of them had come back and said no, I'd have said, okay, maybe this isn't a good idea. But they were both up for it. So at that time, then, the kind of first step was for me and Raheem to start talking about the themes that we wanted to put into the film. We didn't just want it to be an exercise in style. There were certain themes that had been in the short film that then got kind of carried over to the feature, and then we kind of added some extra themes and basically started developing it from there. And Raheem started writing some, basically did write essentially a conventional script for the film that kind of looked at the themes that we had discussed. And we actually went through quite a few drafts of that script. And around the same time, Jim basically wrote a structure for the music. So his structure for the music broke it down into the four movements, but also broke down each of the four movements into the subsections. It told me kind of exactly how long to the second each of those subsections was going to be. And it also told me like the mood, the tone, and the tempo of each of those sections. And Raheem's script had been really specific in terms of kind of images. So one that I always remember is that he had like an empty fish and chip newspaper wrapper kind of blowing down the street. And I never quite wanted to be that specific in terms of going out and essentially setting up an image, because, you know, to get that kind of image, because it is so specific, you end up having to set it up. And that was not really the type of film I wanted to make. Obviously, there is some material in there which is set up, and that was fine. But generally speaking, I wanted to kind of turn up at locations and then just kind of respond naturally to what was happening. So I basically took Raheem's script and from it made a location list, using his script as the jumping off point. So there are certain ideas in the film that kind of came from Raheem's script, such as the focus on food in the second movement was all from Raheem. And then some of them were kind of the themes that we had discussed. So, for instance, the idea of religious diversity, and Raheem had kind of put that in the script a little bit. But I was then able to kind of take the ideas that he put in the script and turn that into a location list and expand on that. So he had written things like the Langor sequence in the Sikh temple, which you see in the film. That's kind of directly from the script. But I was then able to say, well, I want to also then look at more than just one Sikh temple within London and kind of, you know, contrast that with more than just one church and things like that. So we then basically kind of made this location list. And then prior to the edit, I basically kind of rewrote a new script, the kind of editing script, which was taking ideas that I had had, ideas from Raheem's script, taking my thoughts on the rushes, because by that point I kind of knew all the rushes, and I was then able to kind of graft ideas onto Jim's structure. So Jim kind of essentially had given me a whole load of different blocks for the film. So I was able to say, okay, well, that block's going to be old buildings in London. That second block is going to be contrast between old and new. The third part is just going to be the new buildings, et cetera, et cetera. And it's essentially kind of assign each part of Jim's structure a kind of a thematic idea or a location or, you know, something similar, based kind of upon Raheem's script as well. So it definitely evolved. And, you know, there's definitely kind of editorially and directorially strong input from me essentially in the script, but ultimately there is a proper script that Raheem wrote, which, you know, has fed directly into the final product.
Great. Okay, let's turn it over to the audience. Any questions out there? Yep, at the back, Joey.
I know you've had multiple successes with crowdfunding. What are the kind of key success factors that you would kind of recommend for a successful campaign?
I think it comes down to a lot of hard work, essentially. So for our crowdfunding campaign for this, so the campaign itself lasts a month. We planned it for 8 months prior to that. And we basically built up a database of, I can't remember the exact figures now, but I think it was about 1,000 people that we were going to email out to kind of, you know, basically directly contact and say, you know, this is our film, we think you might be interested, here's the link. If you don't want to donate directly, maybe you can forward it on to people that might. So we had about 1,000 people that we knew we were going to email. We had also lined up ambassadors prior to that, that were sort of people that had a following on Twitter or something of that sort, who had agreed in advance that they would kind of spread the link around. What else did we do? We had lined up press in certain key outlets prior to the launch. And then we were also doing stuff like kind of searching for people on Twitter. One of the things we had really good success rate was there's a thing called London Open Houses every year, which is where kind of some of the buildings in London that you can't normally get access to kind of open their doors for the public. And people were tweeting about that using a hashtag. So we would then tweet at them saying, you know, if you enjoy London Open Houses, we think you might enjoy this film. Here's our crowdfunding campaign. And actually quite a lot of people, that was kind of the one of the things we did that had the most success. So it's really just kind of stuff like that. It's just about identifying your target audience. So we had kind of several different target audiences for this. Obvious, you know, people that like London, people that like silent film, people that like architecture, that kind of thing. So you kind of identify who your key audiences are, build up a database in advance. And what's good is to get a lot of people pledging in the first 24 hours, because then Kickstarter will make you like a start pick or something, which is what happened to us, which also helps. But I can't say that I would necessarily recommend crowdfunding, having been through it. I mean, I kind of felt in a way that, you know, we planned this for, in total, you know, something like 8 or 9 months went into the crowdfunding campaign. We made, I might be getting these figures slightly wrong, just off the top of my head, but something like 8,000. The crowdfunding platforms end up taking about 1,000 of that. Realistically, you could probably get a part-time job or a full-time job and, you know, earn that money quicker. Obviously, there are other benefits of crowdfunding, because you are essentially building an audience, which is useful. But you also then have a lot of extra work, depending on what you're kind of promising people. So we promise people regular updates, and we put so much time into our updates. I mean, we've probably gone slightly above and beyond what we needed to, but we're on now on some like 75 updates that we've put out. And you know, each one of those takes an hour or two to put together normally. So we're spending a huge amount of time for actually quite a small amount of people to engage with this material. I felt like for actually what we did, if we'd have kind of done it without that crowdfunding campaign, we wouldn't have had the same pressure. And in a way, that pressure is good, because when there are times where you feel like giving up, you feel like you can't because you've kind of got these backers. And so that pressure is good, but it also makes it more stressful. You know, when you're kind of doing it around full-time job, you think, do I really need this pressure on me to kind of get this finished? We're now, you know, we said we delivered the film a year ago, we still haven't delivered it. So it's a very double-edged sword, I think. And you also need to think about, you know, one of the things we struggled with was, because the film ultimately ended up taking so long, it's all those people that were kind of interested back at the start, how do you keep them engaged throughout the whole process of making the film? Whereas if we kind of just went to them when the film was ready, we might have been able to capitalise on some of that interest slightly better. So, yeah, it's a double-edged sword, I think. Sorry, I'm just waffling.
No, that's really helpful.
Cool. James, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was just interested to know if you did like any storyboarding or anything like that, or if you just turned up that location, whipped the camera out and kind of shot something that looked nice, or if you had, like when you were talking about writers, had kind of set shots that you did want to get of certain stuff, because a lot of it kind of looks like in the moment, kind of capturing random city stuff.
Yeah, so yeah, I mean, I suppose it's shifted slightly. basically, like, prior to starting the shoot, we did a couple of days of walking around London and taking photographs. So when we had made the Hungerford Bridge short film, Raheem and I had basically taken a few hundred photos of the bridge and turned those into storyboards, which we then went out and recreated. And so we kind of considered doing that a little bit with the feature, but I found actually that when I had kind of taken photographs of stuff and then gone back to try and recreate those photographs, I was often not getting the results I wanted. Sometimes, you know, the season would be different, or as I said, the building would be gone. And it quickly became very apparent that it would be much better just to kind of turn up and respond naturally to the location. And also, one of the things that I was trying to do with the film, and this was one of the reasons why I moved away from the script slightly, was I didn't want necessarily the whole film to just be a preconceived idea of London. I wanted to try and find an appropriate response to London as I was making the film. And so it was much nicer, I found, to kind of turn up at a location with a camera, never having been there before, and just kind of filming it as I was responding to it naturally. So that definitely kind of became the way that we worked as we continued. And that we settled on that fairly early on in the process. But we did have like a few hundred photographs from the original recce, and I did try and recreate some of those for the film. But it ultimately also just kind of felt like a waste of time, because we were shooting a lot on DSLR anyway, so it's like, why go to a location, take loads of photographs, when I could just turn up at a location, take loads of footage, and then figure it out. So it's also a time-saving thing, I think.
Other people shot some of the stuff as well, is that right? So
yeah.
What were the discussions around that? You know, how much are you kind of directing them in terms of going out, or are you just letting them have their response to the city in the way that you're having a response when you go out?
Yeah, so basically, we originally had wanted the cinematographer that had done the Hungerford Bridge short film to shoot all of London Symphony. And it became apparent quite early on that that wasn't going to work, partly for logistical reasons and partly for personal reasons on his side. Sadly, had some family stuff. And so when it kind of became clear that that wasn't going to work, we started working with a couple of other cinematographers, and I was going to kind of be like the B camera and they were going to be the A camera, and twice in a row the other cinematographer cancelled on me, so I was suddenly doing these locations alone, and after that I kind of just fell into being one of the lead cinematographers, so it was never ever planned that I was going to kind of be one, and I just kind of fell into it when other people kept cancelling on me. And partly because of that, it then just sort of made sense to have a team of people. So the film was shot on 90 days over the space of about a year and a half. So logistically, it was very complicated. You know, we weren't paying people, so it was logistically complicated to find one person that was going to do all of that. But I also then thought that it would be interesting to have a team of people, because then we could, in the same way that, you know, I was trying to respond naturally. You know, London means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and so it was interesting to then have these different photographers responding to the environment. Some of them were from London, some of them had been there a short time, some of them had been there a long time. So they all had their own kind of unique viewpoint on the city, and that was something that I encouraged, basically. So there were five of us that kind of did the bulk of the filming, and then we had about another 10 people that did kind of a few days. A lot of those 10 people just did one day. There was one guy that just had some footage, a friend of mine had some footage of London and sent it to me, and one of the shots made it into the film, so we give him credit. But a lot of those people, they only have kind of one or two shots in the film, so it's really kind of the five, and then there were kind of maybe three or four of the other 10 that kind of made a proper contribution.
You mentioned there kind of like London means different things to different people. You're touring it now. A lot of cinemas and kind of community centres across London, you know, as well as the rest of the country. I just wondered if there's a, you know, are you noticing that audiences in different places are responding to different things in the film, within London?
Not so much, but what we are finding is that people, it's less about geographical areas and more about individual responses, in fact. So people will be like, you know, that's the bridge where my girlfriend dumped me, or, you know, that's the church that I got married in, or, you know. So it's kind of more individual than that, so it's not even necessarily about the geographical area, it's more about the kind of personal response, and we're definitely seeing a lot of very personal responses. I haven't noticed that much of a reaction kind of between the geographical areas.
Yeah, one down here, then I'll go up the back.
I was just wondering what your approach to editing was, because without a storyboard or shot list, it must be quite daunting when you're starting working on each sequence, and whether some of the themes in the film came out kind of as you're editing, you've realised as you're going through the footage.
Yeah, so, I mean, to be honest, most of the themes were planned in advance. There weren't really that many that I found, and actually most of the footage had been captured precisely for its kind of thematic content. And so because I had this kind of editing script that I had done, I kind of knew roughly where I was going to use a lot of the footage in the edit. And I logged it all very carefully. So I would kind of type in, you know, where it had been shot, what part of the film I thought it was going to go in, because as I said, I'd kind of assigned basically roughly what kind of part of the movement, you know, which movement and which part of the movement it was going to be used in. Put in, you know, how good it was, so gold, silver, bronze, or magic, if it had something kind of really special in. So then it was kind of about, you know, I could go into the edit suite and I could type in British Museum gold, and it would give me all the best footage. And I'd kind of roughly ordered most of the material in the editing script, so I kind of knew what my blocks were. So then it really became about either finding a flow to the images that worked pictorially, or you know, that I could kind of make an extra point through the juxtaposition of images, or it became about a kind of a mini narrative, and narrative is probably too strong a word, but for instance, like the Leighton House Museum stuff, you know, we go into the museum on the ground floor and then we go upstairs, so a lot of those kind of subsequences have some kind of narrative flow to them, which made the structuring of them slightly easier. So a lot of it was kind of fairly planned out in advance in a weird way. And then we were kind of following some of the Eisensteinian types of montage and things like that, which kind of also then helped. And in terms of the way that I was cutting the film, I was doing certain things from a kind of geometric point of view. So you kind of get strong diagonals, you'll notice in a lot of the shots. And so I would cut kind of, you know, left to right diagonal or the right to left. And things like that, so the footage kind of came together by itself in a weird way.
You see it?
Yeah, you already kind of answered the question, but how objective were you at the beginning trying to be, like, the perception of London, how objective you want to be, and how do you think you fulfilled this, like, if it's really subjective film, or you were trying to reach out to a broader.
So I think when we started, it was quite subjective because we were, you know, we had very clear themes that we wanted to express. Raheem did write a script, and so I think that all of that was actually quite subjective and was kind of very deliberate. And then we did start kind of talking to people around the time of our crowdfunding campaign, I guess, and getting a lot of input from other people. So then it became more of an objective project. But then halfway through filming, I was filming a shot, which is in the film, which is of the street where my dad grew up and kind of like the house where my granddad lived until he was quite old. And I realised it was becoming a very personal project again. And so I think we sort of went like this. So started subjective, went objective and ended up being subjective. And I would say that the final version, for better or for worse, is, you know, ultimately is a very authored piece and is, you know, London through my eyes. But having said that, you know, we never lost sight of all the research and all the conversations that we had, so it's not totally subjective, but it is very authored and certainly has a viewpoint to it, for sure.
Yeah.
Why did you put that bit in the middle? I think it was when you were shown the theatre. Why was it in colour? Why did you do that?
So I liked the idea of the kind of the lights of the West End being in colour and kind of being, you know, lights. And then it was also partly a reference to a silent film called Lonesome, which kind of starts a little bit as a city symphony, but then is essentially a romantic drama about two people on Coney Island. And that film also has some colour in it. It was a film that was kind of made on the cusp of the sound era, so there's a silent version and a sound version. But it has this kind of wonderful, like, hand-tinted, stenciled colour in it. And so for us, it was also partly about kind of recognising that silent films... There's a common misconception that silent films are black and white, but they're not. You know, a lot of them kind of have some kind of colouring, whether it's tinting or hand stencil. So it was partly because we wanted to kind of express the lights of the West End in a slightly special way, and it was partly because we wanted to kind of reference the kind of colour of the silent era.
So you've made a character drama and you made a silent film as your two features. What, which way do you think you'll go? Do you think you'll keep making both, or because they're very different? I'm curious as to kind of where your heart lies.
I guess I don't know yet is the answer to that. I mean, my first film, even though it was character drama, was actually quite influenced by silent cinema in terms of the way that I was shooting it. So that it was actually a very talky film. I doubt any of you have seen it, but if you have, it's a very kind of talky drama. But it was, in its filmmaking grammar, was still quite influenced by the silent era. I think London Symphony is kind of unique, and I'd be surprised if I do anything else like that again. But that doesn't mean that I wouldn't do another film that was influenced by the silent era or was somehow using the grammar, or maybe I'll even do another silent. But I don't think I would do another City Symphony. I probably wouldn't do like another silent doc. Yeah, I don't really know is the answer. I mean, two of the projects I'm working on at the moment, one of them is loosely about a screenwriter from the silent era, and one is a kind of gothic horror film that is a remake or an adaptation of a silent film. So there are probably other ways to kind of continue my interest in silent cinema without necessarily doing another one. But yeah, I don't know. Ask me again in 4 years when I know what I'm doing next.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say the film sort of captured London perfectly for me. I live like about 50 miles away from London in Kent, but you still sort of, there's certain things, you're not quite a tourist, but there's still sort of certain things you look at, like the architecture and the buildings. I just felt like it was exactly, and that's some of the places like Kingston and places like that I've been to before, so
great.
Thank you.
I'm from Kingston, so nice shout out.
Oh, nice.
Kingston.
Have you found, what's been the response outside of London? You know, what are they finding, and what are audiences finding in the film if they're not from there?
I think we're finding actually that we're getting a lot of like expat Londoners at the non-London screenings, which has been quite interesting. But I mean, I always kind of thought, I'd be interested to see if you guys agree with this. I mean, I always thought it would be more interesting to non-Londoners because Londoners kind of know the city, and although it's that, you know, it is maybe a slightly different view of London. I always thought that people that don't know London might actually find it more interesting. But generally, the response has kind of been equally good inside and outside of London. And that, you know, you kind of do get people that are sort of like, oh, I never thought about going to London because it's this kind of big, ugly city, but you've made me want to go there, which has been, I guess, quite a nice response.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, generally, it's just kind of been positive.
There was one at the back, and then I'll come to Sylvia. Yeah,
I've got a question. It might have been asked, can I only promote the second half of the film, but first, it kind of, the whole thing reminded me of La Jetée. So, like, but instead of telling one singular story through a series of stills, like, the motion and, like, to me, it was hundreds of different stories, because that's what London is to me. Like, it's so many people just all getting on with their lives and all very separate but interwoven. But from a production side of view, how did you decide who you were going to credit? As in, was it the people whose faces were in it? How did you go about making sure the people who maybe didn't want to be in the film weren't there, and like cast agreements? And that, I guess, is what I'm asking you about.
Yeah, sure. So so basically, everyone that's credited has signed a release form. So. And I think everyone that signed a release form is credited. So that's basically how we figured out the credits. It was, to be honest, it was one of the harder things with the film was this kind of red tape. Like, you know, I mean, we wanted to make a film that was essentially the style of film from the 1920s, but in the 1920s they didn't have so many kind of restrictions on what you could or couldn't do. So it was definitely a challenge that we faced. Luckily, you know, from the kind of approach that I wanted to take to the material, my focus was more on the architecture of the city than the people within the city. So that was kind of a lucky thing. But it was complicated to kind of negotiate. And in terms of the people that are actually in the film, So some of them are crowd funders that kind of one of the like crowdfunding rewards was being in the film. So those people are in the film. There were some people that we did just kind of film and then we asked for permission afterwards. I don't think there was anyone that we filmed that denied us permission. Maybe one student at SOAS. But actually, in the kind of SOAS scene, we were normally kind of saying, can we film you? And then they were kind of giving us permission first. So maybe there was like one person that didn't want us to film them. But generally people were quite laid back about it, actually. Although, like, I was filming on one of the bridges once, and I was just filming the train, and this guy came up to me with his hood on and was like, you're not filming me, are you? Like, quite aggressively. So you do have to kind of be a bit careful. Luckily, I wasn't filming him. But also, obviously, any footage with faces in that we didn't have a release form that was really obvious we just couldn't use. So I had a really nice shot in one of the parks of two people playing with a dog with a giant stick, and I decided that I couldn't use it because you could see their faces very clearly. So yeah, it was a frustrating piece of red tape. But we have, you know, you just have to ultimately get the paperwork. You have to ask people. It's hard when you're a small team because we were always one or two people, so we didn't have a runner to run after people with paperwork, which made it harder. But yeah.
Cool. Sylvia? Yeah.
Did you at any point want the whole film to be in colour? Like, just because London is such a vibrant city and culture is such a colourful and alive thing. So was it because of the tribute to silent film that made it black and white?
Yeah, it was. So yeah, I guess we haven't really spoken about why I wanted to do it as a silent film beyond kind of the stuff I mentioned with the short film. So we also felt that by putting it in kind of an old style, which includes the black and white, we could try and look at life today, but through the lens of the past. So in the same kind of way that historians point to history to try and make sense of life today, we wanted to kind of do something similar with the film and I suppose give you one remove from kind of, you know, life as you would kind of see it naturally today. But also we were looking at the City Symphony essentially as a genre and playing with generic conventions. And for people that kind of know the original City Symphonies, there are clear parallels between the kind of the films of the 20s and what we've done. And those clear parallels were put there to essentially show up the differences between life then and life today. So for instance, in the films of the 20s, you often get people in like kind of metal steel workplaces and kind of pouring molten steel and all this. Whereas for us, today we live in a kind of a digital era rather than an industrial era. So our scenes of people at work as people sitting at an office at a computer. And those kind of scenes at work in our film directly, you know, kind of point back to those films of the 20s. And so the whole style and this idea of the black and white imagery was basically to try and draw a comparison between them and now and kind of highlight the differences between life now and then. And stuff looks better in black and white. So.
Anyone else? Any questions? So what's the plans for the film now? Because obviously you're kind of halfway through the tour. What's going to happen to the film next?
Yeah, so I mean, we'll keep screening it when screening opportunities arise. It came out on Blu-ray in America yesterday, and that's a kind of region-free release, so hopefully people will import it. We're also now streaming all over the world outside of the UK through the same company that's done the Blu-ray. I think we'll probably go out on a VOD platform over here in the next few months, and we're looking at some kind of DVD release here. We're not quite sure what form it'll take. Sadly, in the UK, the kind of traditional DVD market and Blu-ray market is just tiny,
yeah,
and it's getting kind of smaller and smaller. So we haven't yet found a distributor that's willing to take a risk on our film. We'll see whether the kind of success of the theatrical screenings has changed that. But if not, we'll probably do it ourselves. You know, there are kind of viable options for filmmakers that are out there now. So we're basically being asked at pretty much every screening we do for a DVD. So we are kind of determined to get it out on DVD in one way or another.
Right. It's how taxing is it to kind of to be so involved and almost kind of, it's like a cottage industry, you know, you're at the screenings as many as possible and then funding it, filming it, you know, like it's taxing, but it doesn't seem like there's any other way if you want these kind of films out out there.
No, it's absolutely exhausting, and I'm not, you know, quite sure why I did it. It's just one of those things. I mean, I don't think we went into this film totally with our eyes open, and I think if either me or the composer had, you know, known in advance actually how much work and how long it would take, I'm not sure if we would have signed up for it. But, you know, we had an idea, we thought it was a good idea. And, you know, we could tell that there was going to be an audience for the film. I mean, this is what is quite nice about the crowdfunding campaign, is that you're kind of proving that you have an audience. And, you know, if we had failed at our crowdfunding campaign, we probably wouldn't have made the film, because we'd have seen it as a clear indication that there wasn't the market for it. But we could tell very quickly, very early on, that people were going to be interested in what we were doing. And we believed in it. So it then, you know, somehow you find the strength to carry on. And, you know, there were times when I did feel like giving up, but somehow you don't. And yeah, it's just very tough. I mean, I'm not going to lie, you know, doing a kind of independent distribution. You know, we're screening at over 45 venues. I'm kind of doing some of the marketing. I'm, you know, going to the screenings. I'm, you know, with my girlfriend, I'm basically sending out the screening copies to the cinemas. There's all the kind of print management. I mean, there's an incredible amount of, you know, logistics that goes with all of this. And for me personally, I'm creative. I hate all this logistics stuff. This is like the worst part of filmmaking for me, is to be kind of sitting at a computer, basically sending emails all day and like filling in spreadsheets. This is not why I got into filmmaking. But then, you know, you go to the screening and, you know, you talk to people afterwards, and that kind of, I guess, keeps you going a little bit. Would I do it again? Probably not. I think I probably won't do another film. I probably wouldn't direct again unless we were at a budget level where I could have a team rather than kind of being the one that was kind of doing all the brunt of it. But I've done it twice now, so, you know, you have to move up sometime, I think. Yeah.
Well, glad you persevered on this one. Thanks for coming down. Thank you all for coming out for the screening. Please let's thank Alex.
Mama, there's wolves in